Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Cassandra joins me now. Chris, what are we listening to?
That is Meet Me in Music City by Bobby Bear Jr. Definitely one of the best songs about Nashville as we remain in the middle of the state.
Did you eat anywhere interesting last night?
The Grizzlies had a media dinner organized thing that we went to that was very nice of them to do at a restaurant. You know, a very good but sort of nondescript, you know, not a specific, yep, like, you know, genre of food kind of thing, but it was very good.
All right. So evidently the theme yesterday was speed kills. That's what Drew Hill wrote about. He wrote about Jock Landale mostly in his piece. I'd urge people to read it. But the early part of the piece talked about how everyone was talking about speed. Was that sort of an emerging theme yesterday or a continuation?
It was definitely the word of the day, which honestly I found a little bit confusing because the Grizzlies were number one in pace last season. Like, it's not some new development. They're going to play fast. They were the fastest team in the NBA last season, and they've been in the top eight, at least, usually higher than that in pace every season that John Moran has played more than nine games. So, yeah, they're going to play fast. We'll see if they set a new land speed record or something. But, like, you know, speed is sort of already ingrained.
It was interesting. There was a question. One of the, I thought, more interesting moments was Isolo was asked something. There was a question about pace at media day. And he answered it with he wasn't at all dismissive of the question. But he very clearly was like, what are you talking about? There's a million things we can talk about here.
Well,
there's a million ways to register pace and whatever else.
Yeah.
What did you make of that answer, that exchange?
Well, it's never been easier to look up stats and metrics on the internet.
Yeah.
But looking numbers up and citing them is sort of different from understanding them or thinking about them contextually, right? Which is sort of a next order operation. The thing about pace is, and I use the pace number, that's the NBA.com pace number, and I that is basically just a possessions per game kind of thing, or possessions per 48 minutes. But you can look at that in different ways. He was making the point of, like, you know, if you get a lot of offensive rebounds, that might slow down your possession, but that doesn't mean you're necessarily playing slower. Like, there are stats you can look at about, you know, how many seconds or that exist. I don't even know where to find them sometimes, but, like, how many seconds does it take? You know, what's your average seconds to get into your first shot, right? Which would take out the second shot stuff, or what's your average time to get across half court? And different, you know, there's different ways to look at pace, and some of that is easier to find, you know, in the public realm, and some isn't. And so, what we look at and what we talk about as fans and as media isn't always the same thing that, like, coaches look at, because a lot of organizations do their own internal, you know, metrics and numbers.
I gotcha. Do you get a sense that the emphasis on pace is sort of a piece, a part of, I mean, we've had this question of how is he going to deploy, how deep is he going to go on the roster, is he going to limit the minutes, whatever else, and he never disavowed that philosophy last year, even as fans occasionally would grumble about it, or you wonder about the effectiveness of it. Is this all a Do you have any early inclination about his philosophy of that this year?
He hasn't been specific on that subject, but my sense last year was that was as much him as Taylor Jenkins. I think that's the way Taylor Jenkins already liked to play, and the team leaned into it even more, and that was an Isolo influence. I think people conflated the system stuff, you know, a screen-oriented system versus a spaced-out-oriented system.
Right.
You know, the systems that brought players together in interaction, or system versus a system that kept them apart. people conflated that with other things that are not really related to that, in terms of pace, in terms of minutes per game, in terms of depth, in terms of rotation. Like, those are separate things. And I think the distinction on the first was very much an Isolo LaRoche, who's the other assistant coach, like different philosophies and then leaning into one versus the other. But I think everything else was connected to the way Isolo liked to play in Europe and is probably going to play with the Grizzlies. I think the pace, the use of depth, the quicker substitutions, I think all of that. And I talked to him about that, you know, late in the season in a quote I've used many, many times about him saying, you know, that you can make depth and intensity an advantage, but if you can't make it an advantage, you have to go away from it. So I think he will try to make it an advantage.
As you said, they were the quickest team in the league last year. They were also, I don't know where they ranked in turnovers, but it was a real problem, right?
Right.
Turnovers were a real problem. That really, it feels like, had more to do with the other stuff you're talking about, the reads and the way the offense was constructed,
right,
and the reads that had to be made that often weren't, whatever. They were, that's why they were throwing the ball. It was not a product of the pace. It was a product of the other stuff. I think
it was a little bit of both. I do think there were times where they seemed to be in a hurry to be in a hurry.
Yeah.
And maybe some ball handlers who are not as adept were in a hurry to be in a hurry, and that led to some of the problems. But I do think a lot of it was just unfamiliarity. I think the system was asking more players to sort of handle the ball and make plays, and to do so with, like, you know, cut spacing and cutting patterns that they weren't, like, used to, because it was new and novel.
Yep.
And I think it was both of those things. But I also think it was also a ball handler limitation. I think Desmond Bane was overtaxed as a ball handler last season in particular. I think Scottie Pippen had a lot of turnover problems. Obviously, Pippen is back. I think you hope that that aspect of his game improves. But I think bringing in Ty Jerome gives them another ball handler who's a little bit more used to handling the ball against pressure. And so you hope that sort of that aspect of the team improves.
You obviously want a team that can score quickly and that, when forced to play half-court offense, are efficient with their half-court offense. It has felt like different years – one has been more of a point of emphasis in the ways they talk to the media. Like, it's,
right,
when was it? Like, it was, we've got to be better on our half court offense. Became a theme 2 years ago. Was that it? Right now, and now we're back to the emphasis was with Isola. Was it's easier to score before they get their defense organized? Like, that was a big point of emphasis. Again, this is just the way he talks to us. I'm sure they want an efficient half court offense. Do you make anything of the way they're talking about this as compared to past years?
No, I think we tend to make too much of talk.
Right.
But right now, that's all we got.
Yep.
And so that's what we're doing. And there hasn't been that much of it, honestly. Like, you know, Isolo talked for like 8 minutes on media day. And he talked for like 8 minutes yesterday. And that's only like 16 minutes of talking, you know. And and he's talking a lot more when the doors are closed to the team. And
right.
So I think it'll be a process of we will learn more the more they talk and then the more we see them play. But I do think, to the point of sort of focusing on the pace and, you know, the general principle that I think is pretty widespread at this point in basketball, that, like, it's easier to get offense against a defense that's not set yet. And so it's not just that speed is better, it's that getting shots against in early offense before defense is set is better, and you do that by playing fast. But to the point I think you're sort of alluding to, at some point the defense is going to get set, right? And it
right.
may get set more often in playoff basketball. And so the thing where the point of emphasis that they seem to have gone away from as a point of emphasis, at least in terms of talking, is going to have to become a point of emphasis again at some point.
Yeah, it felt like that was more of a product of they were in the playoffs then, and they were,
right.
you know, and they that's what had cooked them, right? Their inefficient half-court offense. And so that became a talking point in the next season. Now it's sort of like, we're going to have to rebuild this thing. And so it's a slightly different point of emphasis. But you're right, they're obviously addressing all of this behind closed doors. Okay, another thing I want to ask you about yesterday that I didn't get to, I really did think one of the more interesting exchanges of Media Day was you and KCP when you asked him about his three-point shooting, because he didn't you asked if what it was a product of the Orlando offense, and he didn't go out of his way to throw Orlando under the bus. But, like, he was pretty clear, like, what did he talk about? Consistency of shots or whatever. Where I thought he was very thoughtful talking about his three-point shooting in a way that he wasn't didn't feel like he was blameless or anything. I think he was just being thoughtful in the way he talked about it. What did you make of all that?
This is something I had looked at either earlier that morning or maybe the day before. And when he brought up in response to an earlier question about trying to get his 3-point percentage up, I went ahead and asked him because I'd already done a little bit of work on that subject. And to me, it seems like what he's saying should be correct based on the fact that he was a good shooter for 10 years from 3-point range. And then it takes a sudden significant dip in the one season. He's on a new team that doesn't have a point guard. Right. So that seems like that is an accurate assessment. I will say that assessment is not discernible in the numbers, even when you look close.
Really?
But maybe it's discernible on film, right? There's a limit to what the numbers tell you. Because I looked at year, comparing last year to the year before, like, did he take a higher percentage of threes later in the clock? Did he take a higher percentage of threes with closer defenders? And, like, the numbers don't really tell you any of that. Numbers say that's not the answer. But, again, I think if you actually really watch it, that may be beyond what the numbers can capture as far as that goes. But one thing I did note with him is that it was really 3-point shooting was the only thing that dipped. I mean, his free throw percentage was still great. He took more long twos than any year of his career and hit a career high percentage of them. Like, I don't know how much difference there is between taking a 20 footer and a 23 footer. There is a difference there, but like for a guy who's 32 years old and has been an NBA player for 10 years, I don't think there's necessarily that much difference. And his defense was by all measures, his defense was still very good. And so in the absence of until it is proven otherwise for the Grizzlies this season, I assume that 3-point dip was either a fluke, because that happens with shooting, there's shooting variance for 3-point shooting, or B, there were environmental factors that made him a worse shooter in Orlando than he had been before in Los Angeles and Denver, and that he will be again in Memphis. So my assumption is that shooting is going to bounce back, but we'll find out.
Elsewhere in the NBA, the Jonathan Kuminga saga has come to an end. 2 years, $48.5 million. Your thoughts?
Our great national nightmare is over, I guess.
No. I mean, it is not. It is not, Chris.
Okay. It's been pushed along a little bit. I mean, we'll revisit at the trade deadline, maybe. I don't know. I mean, it's good for him. I mean, his qualifying offer, I think it was like $9 million. And so, good for him, or whatever it was. It was less than what he just signed for this coming season. So good for him to, like, get money. And it gets money in a way that still ties him to this team he doesn't really want to be on.
Right.
But it doesn't tie him long term. So he gets more money than he would get otherwise. And there's still, whether it's in season this year or next summer or whatever, there is still light. There's still light at the end of the tunnel for him to be elsewhere at some point.
It felt like, though, the Warriors sort of got what they wanted here, which is they retain him as a trade chip, and they had to toss him a little more money. I think this offer was richer than their previous one, but there's still team option for the second year. They got him. They just had to pay him a little more to get what they wanted, and he didn't want to risk 1 year on the $9 million or whatever it was.
He's 22
sense.
Years old. It's a two-year thing. So even if they do the team option and they don't trade him and they keep him for 2 years, you've pocketed 40-something million, and now you're 24-year-old unrestricted free agent. So, there are worse things to be in the world than, like, oh, my God, I'm tied to the Warriors again for $20-something million dollars,
Yeah. Your piece on what's happening in Memphis film is out. So I urge people to read it over at the Daily Memphian. You've seen one battle after another. And people can read what you thought about it, but give us a thumbnail.
Yeah, it's sort of hard to do a thumbnail. It's a 3-hour movie. I think it's really good. I think it's really interesting. And I think it's really, it's a movie that the gestation to some degree, you go back to the 1980s. It's inspired by a book written in the 90s that's set in the 80s. And the director started conceiving doing a movie about it 20 years ago. And it feels like it was conceived and created today, basically. So it's extremely in conversation with the country today. And whether that's in good ways or bad ways is sort of, you know, up to you, but in ways that I find pretty pertinent.
How is DiCaprio?
DiCaprio's great. Benicio del Toro is great. It's Sensei Sergio, which may become like my new online avatar. I just may just become Sensei Sergio. I may just not answer to anything else. My new culture hero. And the ending of the movie like really hit me with a wallop, but you know, people can decide for themselves.
All right. Also out this week, I guess, is The Smashing Machine. What is The Smashing Machine?
It's a sports movie, if you consider like guys trying to beat each other's brains out of sport. It's a mixed martial arts biopic about the UFC fighter Mark Kerr, who I don't know anything about, but he was a UFC fighter of note, I guess, 20 years ago. And Dwayne Johnson, a.k.a. The Rock, under some heavy prosthetics, is playing the lead role. Emily Blunt is the girlfriend or wife, you know, whichever the case may be. It's directed by one of the Safdie brothers, who are these New York filmmakers who did this Adam Sandler movie, Uncut Gems, a few years ago that was highly regarded. And it's one of these movies that, like, you know, it's like, is The Rock going to be nominated for an Oscar? And it seems like the answer is at least maybe on this one.
Okay, and then we have tonight at Studio in the Square where they have Throwback Thursday. Again, you can read the piece for more about what's happening across the film scene in Memphis. But we got 16 Candles tonight at Studio in the Square. Did you see it again? You said it. You referred to whether how it holds up or does not hold up. Did you rewatch or have you rewatched recently?
Not this week, but I've seen it. I mean, I saw it when I was a kid or whatever. Yeah. Probably not in theaters. Probably on VHS or whatever. And I've seen it at some point in the last 20 years. Enough to I remember. I remember like the Long Dong Chong or whatever, like ridiculous Asian character going on. It's not as bad as Breakfast at Tiffany's, but I think it's probably pretty bad now.
All right. Chris, thanks very much.
All right.
Chris Harrington from the Daily Memphian as the Grizzlies continue training camp over there in Nashville. We got Sam Hardiman coming up next. Before that, I will remind you, if you're looking for a place to go eat tonight, tomorrow, this weekend, Ragin' Cajun, try it. If you haven't tried it, try it. If you've been, I don't have to tell you to go again because you will. And like, there's little touches. Like again, Mason Jambon, who started it, wanted a neighborhood place that reminded him of the neighborhood places where he grew up in New Orleans. So among other things, you got to get your bread from New Orleans. Leidenheimer bread comes up. So your po' boys are going to be authentic. Fabulous fried oyster, shrimp, roast beef, and Dewey sausage, all of that. I just love a po' boy. It's just, and to think, I grew up without, I don't know that I ever ate a po' boy in Buffalo. That's a deprived youth. Anyway, they are deprived childhood. Absolutely sensational. The sausage and cheese plate is terrific. The crawfish queso, I was surprised by. Never thought to order crawfish. It's like queso. Cheesy deliciousness with chips, only it's got crawfish in it. Great outside seating, cold drinks, great food, neighborhood feel. It is Ragin' Cajun, 2740 Bartlett Road in Bartlett. Took us 7 minutes from East Memphis to get there. Try it today. Try it tomorrow. Try it this weekend. Check it out online if you like. Cajun901.com. It's Ragin' Cajun. We're going to come back, talk to Sam Hardiman on the other side. Jeff Calkins Show, 92.9 FM ESPN.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns.
You know why
fans.
It's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos. Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, back on the Jeff Calkins Show. Joined now by Sam Hardiman from the Daily Memphian. Writes about the city. So, Sam, before that, we got a big tilt this weekend. Your New England Patriots and my Buffalo Bills Sunday night football. And we were speculating earlier. You know, you don't think the Pats are fully baked, and you're not a man who is averse to getting a higher draft pick. You wanted the Bills to win the game against the Pats at the end of last year, which they did not. So Jeffrey and I were debating who you want to win, and I'm quite convinced that this early in the season, the Pats are 2-2. You want them to beat the hell out of the Bills. That's my prediction.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be so optimistic to say that the Patriots are going to beat the hell out of the Bills. I don't think they have the talent on the roster. But I was reflecting on this because you gave me a heads up we're going to talk about this.
Uh-huh.
And I do want them to win because I was looking at the NFL standings, and I just feel the realistic outcome here is like the Patriots either are a wild card team or they're like in the wild card hunt until the last weekend, the last two weekends. And then they sort of get a middling first round pick this year. Like looking at like the detritus of the NFL right now, I don't think the Patriots suck enough to be in that group of teams, right? Like the Saints are so bad. The Panthers, who I was optimistic about, very bad, right? Like it's just, there's just a lot of bad teams. Like what's going on?
And the bad is really bad. Like they're terrible. You know, there's some bad teams. There's some bad teams that are really bad.
Right.
And the Pats are not that. You know, and they have their quarterback. So, yeah, this early in the season, when you got your quarterback, you want to be in the mix. And you might as well continue to be in the mix. And it's more fun to win games. Now, I'll say that. Do you put any stock in the it does them good to be in competitive situations long haul, whether they make it or not? Like that experience itself is good?
Yes, I do, because I think you have, like, with a young team, with a team that is, you know, gelling together, and, you have a coach that, you know, constantly is talking about, like, the habits and culture he wants to bring, right? The habits and culture he wants to bring are winning and winning close games and playing good football, and as he said last week, taking advantage of bad football teams. And the Bills are clearly a great football team, and so I think it's an appropriate measuring stick for the Patriots and something that, yeah, they should be aspiring to play a tight one possession game against the Bills this weekend. That's what they should be doing because that's progress. You know, Rome wasn't built in a day.
No, it clearly was not. And neither was the Memphis Safe Task Force, but we'll talk about that in just a moment. If you look at the wild card situation too, like with the Bengals bungling, you know, whatever, the Ravens collapsing, the quarterback issues everywhere, it actually seems more realistic to be in the mix in the wild card situation than I would have thought it would have been for the Pats as the year. I mean, Houston, same thing. Houston's not great. Like there's a bunch of teams. So whatever, you'll be competing with the Jags for being in the playoff mix, and so there you go. Well, that'll be fun. How is your dad holding up after the Yankees loss yesterday?
Yeah, it wasn't – the vibes in our text messages were not great. I'm going to say that. You know, like I was at the mayor's town hall last night, and my father has not been a fan of Aaron Boone for some time. Like he actively boos him when he goes to a game and like he's introduced. And Aaron Boone made the questionable decision to pull Max Fried in the seventh inning last night. Luke Weaver, who's been a stalwart for the Yankees but really hasn't had it this year, gave up the two runs, and that turns out to be the margin. And then the Yankees had bases loaded, nobody out in the ninth inning, and don't get it done against, you know, former Yankee Aroldis Chapman. Yeah, my dad was not happy. We haven't spoken this morning. It's ahead of Yom Kippur as well, and so he's always a little edgy ahead of the fast, as I am. And so, yeah, it's not great.
All right. You were at the town hall. I guess that's as good a way to get into it as anything. What happened at the, what was the town hall and, how did it go?
Yeah. The mayor, hosted a town hall last night. He's been doing these. He did a ton of them last year, his first year office. He's been doing some this year. And, this one was interesting in the sense that it was on his home turf. This was in his mother and brother's church, the Healing Center Full Gospel Baptist Church down in Oak Haven. Very nice place. And he last night, you know, largely took questions from the public. They addressed at the outset the National Guard. And surprisingly, there were relatively few questions about the National Guard. A lot of questions about potholes, a lot of questions about tree trimming, stuff like that. And then I'm trying to remember how Davis, Police Chief CJ Davis, was asked this question. But CJ Davis took the microphone And she, as someone, as we've discussed before, Jeff, is not someone that makes a ton of public comments.
Yep.
Really, and is very circumspect when she does. But she said, and you know, I think in response to somebody when the National Guard was going to be here, said, we're thinking it's going to be 2 weeks. And she, you know, gave some revealing comments that really the city of Memphis had limited information about what was happening with the National Guard and the Memphis Safe Task Force. And she said, and, you know, I'm paraphrasing her here, that, you know, she had finally had a long briefing on Tuesday and now had more information, but still was waiting under information about when the National Guard would arrive.
Huh. So it's interesting you said there were not that many questions about the National Guard. It struck me that, you know, in some cities this has been met both from officialdom, but also from the populace with fierce opposition, or has been or would be met with fierce opposition, this entire enterprise. And it seems to me that it's been interesting that in Memphis, there's a sort of ambivalence about it. Both in the city council and in county commission, you were not able to get pass resolutions sort of asking Bill Lee to not, you know, bring in the National Guard. There have been clearly protests and people who are fiercely opposed to this. But then there's also been a fair, we kind of need the help. Like I get a lot of that from people that I talk to. And then I'm just intrigued that it wasn't a particular topic of conversation at last night's event. It wasn't, because one would think that it would be, right? I don't know. I guess I want to revisit that point. It was not the emphasis.
I wouldn't say it wasn't the emphasis. What I would say is it didn't dominate the conversation, right? Like, it was definitely a solid segment of the questions, but at the same time, these were, you know, people in Oak Haven, regular people who are getting access to the mayor and city officials that they normally don't get. And they were asking questions, I think, that were much more pressing in the Maslow's hierarchy of needs of their daily life, right? They were talking about blight in their community. They were talking about, you know, there was a discussion of a specific, you know, site nearby where people were illegally dumping trash. And that was something that they were really concerned about. And so I wouldn't read too much into the vibe last night of this meeting being just not interest in the National Guard, but more focused on just local, really pressing, like hyper local issues. I would also say, in terms of the what you described as ambivalence from the Memphis City Council and the Shelby County Commission in these resolutions, I think what I would want to say to counter that, and I don't necessarily wholly disagree with the way you're characterizing it, but I would say to counter it, I would say there was an awareness at the Memphis City Council level that the resolution, you know, asking the governor not to do this was powerless.
Yep.
And there was the question made to Alan Wade, the longtime city council attorney, what does it effectively do? And he said nothing. I think that made up the minds of some of the people who either didn't vote for it or abstained. And I also want to read a quote from the mayor gave us when we did a little gaggle last night.
Yeah.
Because I think this maybe characterizes the mayor's thoughts clearly, but it also may characterize how a lot of Memphians feel about this.
Yep.
Quote, my position on this has been clear. It's not something that I asked for. It's not something that I thought is the best way to reduce crime. But the governor and the president have made a decision, Young said. We are not in the same position as other cities with Democratic governors that have opposed the presence of those federal entities coming into the community. And he said more, but I'll leave it there because I want to emphasize for people that's the key distinction here, right?
Yep.
Like, J.B. Pritzker in Illinois can, you know, because he controls the National Guard in Illinois, just like Bill Lee controls it here, can decline to have the National Guard come to Chicago, which the president clearly wants to do, right? He can decline that, right? In Los Angeles, the president sent the National Guard under other legal authority that turned out to not be the correct legal authority because Gavin Newsom didn't want that to happen. Here we have Governor Bill Lee, a Republican governor, who is the one authorizing the guard here. And so what you have is the same party as the president in the governor's office acquiescing to what the president wants And so the Democrat mayor, who's really a nonpartisan office, but polling as a Democrat, is really kind of powerless to stop that. And so I think, you know, I would love to see polling on this. I'm going to go beat, you know, certain doors down in the Daily Memphian after we get off the phone here that we should poll on this, because I would love to know how people feel. Are they ambivalent about it? Or are they just like, we can't stop it?
Maybe there's a certain ambivalence come with that. Well, and to the point, it's not just that there's a difference in legal authority of the governor here. In practically speaking, if, like, Memphis needs things from Nashville, and we've honestly seen a certain vindictiveness at various moments, if you don't do what Nashville wants, if you take down statute, whatever, if you do different things than Nashville, there can be hell to pay. And so it's not just that there is a Republican governor who can activate the National Guard as opposed to a Democrat one. It's that there can be other repercussions that would be really harmful to the city if you don't go along with this. And so it feels like that might be a big part of it as well. When are they going to arrive? That came up that you said 2 weeks Chief Davis said?
Yeah, Davis said we should see them, the first appointments, in 2 weeks. And again, I want to emphasize a comment that Davis made, and she said this, and I'm paraphrasing her here, but like, the plane is being built on the runway is what Davis said. And that she refers to all the Memphis State Task Force, not just the National Guard, because let's be clear. We have significant federal law enforcement presence in the city right now that are making arrests and making traffic stops. Like, before I got on this phone call, I was going through some of the affidavits in which these people are being arrested and charged, right? And so there's a significant federal law enforcement presence in the city right now. But what Davis is saying is this is sort of evolving as it's happening. And as we've talked about before, Jeff, a lot of the announcements of this initiative were really far ahead of the initiative of itself. And I think now, particularly with the chief's comments last night, we're really seeing that, you know, that this was being talked about for political points on television, but it was not actually fully baked yet. And now we're seeing it starting to actually get baked.
And in terms of the other agencies that are here, like, they don't announce themselves. They don't say, right, this many ICE folks are here and this many from, right? We're just sort of perceiving it. Is that what's happening? Like, there's some general awareness that they're here and they're making arrests, and you see it in these affidavits?
Yeah, I mean, they are here. There is a staging ground out by Shelby Farms where the task force is. They're not, you know, exactly, I don't think, announcing themselves. I think they likely identify themselves when they pull people over.
Right.
I would imagine they do that. But there has not yet been, and David said there's a potential for this, there has not yet been like a regular cadence of, hey, this is what we're doing, this is how we're doing it, here's a press briefing, right? Like, David's talked about there's a potential for regular press briefings, you know, on an almost daily basis, like we had during COVID from this task force. It hasn't happened yet, but that's something she said is on the table. So yeah, no, we don't exactly have like clear specificity on how many ICE people are here, how many Homeland Security officers are here. Absolutely not. We don't have that yet.
All right. You also wrote a really interesting piece Monday about why, when my power is out, my neighbor's is not out. And I honestly, I think people should go, it's technical enough, although you wrote it in a very easy to digest manner. I think people should go read the piece at the Daily Memphian. How did you get them? So you couldn't, like, they won't show you an actual grid for security reasons. So they literally came up with a fake grid, which you used to illustrate, here's how this power gets to your house and why. I don't know if there's a way you can discuss this in any thumbnail way, because it is pretty darn technical, even though you made it incredibly digestible.
Well, thank you. Yeah. So first of all, MLGW really does hate you specifically. Right. They are turning your lights off more than anybody else's. No, just I kid. So Ben Seaton, who's a reliability manager and Don Roberts' boss at MLGW, were kind enough to sit down with me about a week ago. And they described how the grid works, and we're not going to get super technical, as Jeff said, but essentially, if you are looking across the street at your neighbor's house and the neighbor's lights are on and yours are off, and the neighbor to your left and right are off, but the people directly across from you are off, it's likely because you are literally connecting to the grid in a very different way. And essentially, if you think of the grid as a spider web, and it really is, all these electrical wires all over the place are a spider web because they have to interconnect. They have to balance each other out. They have to be able to, MLGW has to be able to send power from one way to another different ways in case something happens. And so it really is important for people when you're experiencing these power outages, which are incredibly frustrating. And believe me, I went through it watching my neighbors during the 2021 ice storm across the street from me watch reality TV. It was creepy. I would watch and sit in my window and watch them watch TV while I watched the thermostat in my apartment go down to 48 degrees because it was that cold and we didn't have power for 5 days. And I was like, why are their lights on? Rah, rah, rah. And it's really because even though you are so close together, there are different circuits that may feed your neighbors across the street, and then a different tap, which is a line that comes off the circuit, may feed your neighbor next door to you. And so it's a very complicated system, and people should read it.
One of the things, though, that I wonder about is this.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily why mine is out and different wires. The question is why did they get theirs back? Let's say we're both out, right? Why did they get theirs back on before mine? Why did they prioritize theirs before mine?
Yeah, and that's a good question. Part of it is just workflow, right? That outage may have been reported first. There's also the chance that those people are on a circuit that has really necessary infrastructure, right? So if a circuit goes down that has a hospital on it or a school or a nursing home or something like that, that's going to get priority because that's people that need it and need to live, right? Versus just you and me and, we can't watch TV. You know, and so that it may be workflow, B, it may just be those are higher priority folks because of what is on that circuit.
Sam, appreciate it. People can read the piece at the Daily Memphian, and I hope you have an easy fast and go Bills. Thanks, Sam.
Thanks, Jeff.
See you. All right. Leaders Credit Union is a financial institution. And when Claire moved to Memphis and I said, where should I have a bank? I said, well, Leaders, of course. And then with her kids, where should they bank? I said, Leaders, of course. Because they're great. I mean, listen, what do you want out of a bank? You want someone to answer the phone. You want an app that it makes it easy for you. You want to know that you're not getting nickel and dimed. You want good rates, great rates, right? Whether it's on your mortgage or on your car loan or on your checking account. And my experience has been, you get those things at Leaders. And it stands to reason because as a credit union, there's no stockholders who need to get rich. There's no, they don't have to be juicing the stock every day. Literally every dollar goes back into that technology, into those services, into those rates. It's Leaders Credit Union. There's a branch in Bartlett. There's a brand new branch in Arlington. You can walk on in there and see what I saw. We went to the one in Bartlett. Or you can just download the app. Or check them out at leaderscu.com/ESPN. We're going to take a break. Back in a moment. Jeff Calkins Show, 92.9 FM ESPN.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns
You know
fans.
Why it's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos.
Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, back on the Jeff Calkins Show. What are you looking forward to tonight, Jeffrey?
I mean, I think...
And we started with baseball.
Yeah, I mean, I think you got to say it kind of sucks to admit it. It's like Red Sox-Yankees.
Red Sox-Yankees.
Yeah.
Do you want it tied?
No. Red Sox won.
You're anti-Yankees in all things?
Yeah, I found the made-up Aaron Judge home run chase.
Oh, that's right.
Annoyed and angered me at a level that I don't think I've had in
You know, like 10 years. I find myself sympathetic to Kathy Engelbert. Didn't know her name before yesterday.
Yes.
She's getting just destroyed. She's the WNBA commissioner.
Yes.
But if you look at the reasons for which she's getting destroyed, one is officiating,
yep.
right? Leagues get destroyed for officiating. You know what I mean? Like there was an injury, whatever like that. And the other is, and the bigger one here is the collective bargaining agreement. Well, you're not going to win friends from players when you are, you know, when you're in a negotiation.
Well,
and what happened
reason.
Here was a player quoted her and said, this is what she said to me. But there's no evidence that those are the words she actually said. Like, I don't know. She may be the worst commissioner ever, like she's being described. But what it seems to me is this is basically a fight about money. And one side has decided you're not giving us enough of money. And they may be right. But I don't know that it actually means she's the worst commissioner in the world.
Well, there's a third reason.
What?
Phillips, she's heavily invested in
the other league. I mean, it is a problem. It is absolutely a problem. Well, the women basketball players, you know, should be getting more money. But that's what the fight's about. Like, I don't know if she's the worst in the world.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I mean, I think their leadership has proven to be bad.
On a lot of fronts.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's true, too. What is coming up next on 92.9?
Jeff, here's what's coming next on Jason and John. Coach Hurd joins them, and you will join them today. Coach Hurd with me on Jeffrey Wright and Company. Jason Munns will join us during the first hour. Cobb with Gabe at 5:00.
Yeah, we'll be back tomorrow. Let's all band together during the shutdown and see if we can get through it. But we'll be back tomorrow one way or another. For now, work is done.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns
You know
fans.
Why it's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos.
Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.